Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of rumradio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and rumradio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on rumradio.org.
Welcome and hello. Well, thanks, Mom. That's Mom out there. She made it back this week. That's the only one in the audience is my mom. Isn't she enthusiastic? That's the key to recovery is enthusiasm, which means the God within you. And when people say namaste, that's what they're saying. I honor the God within you. And that's enthusiasm. That's what we try to have here. We might not, you know, we might not be AA, CA, or NA, and we're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. But nobody will tell you where to hold the meetings. And if you hang in with us long enough, you might think it's Narcoleptics Anonymous. No, we should have a great show tonight. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe has shrunk down a little bit, like you folks have been hearing me talk about it. The the GSO, that's the General Service Organization, not the KGB, but the GSO of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of the Grapevine, which is our monthly meeting in print, has produced a book, and it's called One-on-One Sponsorship. It's the first time this organization has produced such a work in its 78 years, and we think this is might be somewhat of a game changer to put the energy back into one-on-one sponsorship. That's how it started, that's how it's supposed to work, and that's where we're headed back for, one-on-one sponsorship. So we couldn't be happier at Rum Radio to see this change in direction. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this for us as a public service presentation. They do it without charge, and that's a really good price. Thanks, guys. Every little bit helps. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. And I gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe the families are the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, so does the world. In our experience, or my personal experience, children are not being taught correct principles. Once you teach a child correct principles, they can teach themselves. But until those principles are taught, they learn from groups, gangs, clubs, cliques, the mean streets. They grow up like empty lot weeds, latchkey kids. You've heard the term. This is what the prisons are filled with. This is what we're looking at as far as addiction, drugs, and alcohol, is that learning curve, peer pressure, violence. Well, it's a mess. Well, you know what you can do? Burke said it. Evil prevails when good men do nothing. So we do what we can. I like to think of us like starfish thrower. A red tide comes in and it litters a beach with millions of starfish. And this fellow's down there and he's tossing them back one at a time. That's the fellow pulls up and says, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm tossing them back. It gives them life again. He says, well, there's millions of them. You're never going to get to all of them. He says, I know, but I can get to some, and I do what I can. And that's what we do at Rum Radio. We do what we can. Harold, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Joseph, for that introduction. And, yes, the kids are really struggling. The way I think kids, especially adolescent boys, need more time with their dads. They just need more time. Bonding is done through smell, ladies and gentlemen, through smell. We need to be around our kids, with our kids. We need to hug our kids. They need to know that we love them and appreciate them. The sad fact is that the research now shows that if we average out the amount of time a dad spends with his kids, and this is boys or girls, adolescents or elementary age kids, it averages out to 45 seconds a day, which means the dads are spending about 5 minutes a week with each of their kids one-on-one. That's just not enough. The kids need attention. They're craving attention. If they don't get positive attention, they will settle for negative attention, and they can get that at school by putting vodka in a water bottle, taking it to school, passing it around, acting like a big shot. So now a lot of the Houston schools don't allow water bottles for that reason. So, folks, we've got to spend more time one-on-one with our kids and doing family fun things together. So that's my little soapbox for tonight. I'd like to let our audience know that we're doing this as a public service. Joseph doesn't make a penny from the website or the radio program. In fact, it costs him a lot to keep both going, so I want to appreciate him for that, footing that bill. This is our way of giving back. The 12-step programs have literally saved our lives, and we hope that you get some value tonight from the program. The phone number to call in, if you'd like to call in and ask a question or participate, is 949-534-0621, and that's for Sunday evenings at 9 Central Time, 9 to 10 Central. 949-534-0621. And so thank you for putting the program together, Joseph, and thank you for the website also. I've gotten a lot of value, and I know our listeners do too. You archive all the programs, and I know that we get a lot of listeners, a lot of people listening to the archived programs. So I'll turn it back to you, Joseph.
Harold, are we going to be doing the chat room area tonight?
I haven't been able to get that open yet, so I'll let you know when I do.
Okay, great. Thanks, Harold. Before I get started, our guest tonight is Gary Kay. Now, if you want to use your last name, that's fine.
Oh, sure. That's absolutely fine.
Oh, yeah, okay. You got to remember, this isn't AA or NA or CA, so
sure.
We're really not affiliated. We did an interview with Greg Williams, and I love the way he's doing Anonymous People. And he's having people of note come out saying about their addiction and how they're handling it. And the way they address it is that, like, I would say, hi, my name is Joseph Gansey. I'm a person in long-term recovery. And this way you can use your last name and you're not breaking the 11th tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous or NA or CA because there's no affiliation. And that's the key to the anonymity. Personally, it's your decision whether you want publicly to know, but that you're not affiliated with any particular program. So by doing that, you're not speaking for that program, and in that sense, there's no, it's not breaking the 11th tradition. I love the way they couch that, and so they can bring it out into the open and let people know that this is a epidemic. So before, if you just wait for a little minute, Gary, and I like to start the show with the third step prayer. That's all right?
Absolutely.
Thank you. The third step prayer is found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We like to use the Big Book because it's the template for all 12-step programs. All 12-step programs come from that understanding. Matter of fact, other programs use 12 steps, and if they do, AA, the only thing AA asks them to do if they're going to change it is to have the original available on the same page or the next page. So people can say, see what the original looks like and then what the changes look like to keep it. And that's the only thing AA asks. No money, none of that. It's really quite an open deal. You have to applaud those folks for their openness and willingness to help the next sufferer. The third step prayer is on is one of the first assignments I give to a new sponsee when they make the transition from prospect, which is a possible person in recovery, to a sponsee, which means they've committed that they're willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety, and they've agreed that they've had enough. And those two agreements, then I give them a list of questions, Clancy, 7 questions. If I get them back the next day, they always look at me. But you got to remember, the new person who doesn't know anything doesn't know what they don't know. So they don't know what the culture says or how it's done. All they know is what you're telling them. And if they're in pain when they come in, you know what? They're willing to take any suggestion. You're the answer guy. Oh, this is the way they do it. So I need that back the next day. I get him back the next day. He's demonstrated he's willing to go to any length, and we get started. Now he's a sponsee. Get a home group. This is not in the Big Book, but it's a good idea anyway. You get a home group because that's their lifeline group. And find like 30 net. Is that you, Harold, in the background? I hear a lot of buzzing around.
Hello?
Yeah. Harold, is that you? Or? Oh, I hear a lot of banging.
No, I'm...
So I was, okay.
Oh,
anyway,
no,
so
I'm not banging.
Okay. And so that would be the lifeline group. And so to call one of the fellows every day and ask them permission to recite the third step prayer. I do that for several reasons. One, it gets them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it helps connect him up with his home group or his lifeline group. They get to know his name, and they get to know, he gets to know their name, and they get to know his name. The first step prayer is also called the surrender prayer, which is going to be what we're going to try to accomplish, encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the person might have been thinking about picking up his first drink, doing his first hit of crack or his first whatever, and chances are this might help him dissuade from that, and your sponsee is already at the service, which we find that to be the quintessential ability to stay sober. Intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. So your goal is to get your sponsee to a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience, and then get him into the trenches working with the next sufferer. We find this to be the most productive way of attaining and maintaining long-term sobriety. But if you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Amen.
May I do thy will always.
Always, yeah. Always is a long time. We this way do it one day at a time. You know, we don't deal in higher platitudes. That's why we call it a trudge. And that means we're taking a journey. There's no, we don't go for the perfection deal. We're more like a spiritual progress. But we do the best we can, and that's good enough sometimes. So, Gary, tell us, thank you so much for being on.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. You're quite welcome. So tell us, what was it like?
Well, for me, it was hell on earth. Really, for me, addiction started, I was really aware of it first when I was a small child, and I would come home from school every day, and I would, my father, when he mowed the lawn, he had a quart container that he made iced tea in, and I would make chocolate milk and put about a half a box of Nestle's Quick in that and eat a box of Pop-Tarts, and I'd be passed out on the couch before dinner. And to me, that was addiction before I ever met alcohol or cocaine or any other kind of drugs. And so it started early for me. And by the time I was had graduated from high school, I had had 11 total automobile accidents. When I was 16, I had my license for 3 days. I drank, went into a blackout, and killed 2 people in an automobile accident. And,
holy cow! How old were you when you started drinking? You sounded like you had an addictive personality. You were you sugar binging.
I totally
binging.
Did. Right. About when I was about 13, my parents used to take me on weekends to the home of a relative where I was. It was an abusive situation, and I didn't know how to ask for help. And my father. And this went on from when I was 8 until maybe 12 or something like that. And my father helped line up automobiles for the Football Hall of Fame parade. I'm from Canton, Akron area in Ohio. And he didn't drink. My mother didn't drink. Nobody in my family drank. They didn't do drugs. They didn't smoke. They went to church. They lived in what I know to be the steps without ever having read the steps. They were decent, honest, kind people that did service, and that's who raised me. Which is one of the ways I understand that I have a disease that is not a respecter of persons. It doesn't matter where you came from or how much education you had or if your family loved you or they didn't. It's a disease, and it got me early. In any event, my father was given a decanter of very old Jim Beam whiskey by the Board of Trustees of the Football Hall of Fame. The decanter was in the shape of the it looked like the Hall of Fame. And he put it in a shadow box, and it was a very valuable thing. Not the whiskey that was in that bottle. And he always told me, never touch that thing, and he was adamant about it. He had been a UDS in World War II, and he had missing part of one of his hands, and he said, if you ever touch that, the hand that had 4 fingers, that was hospital, and the other one was sudden death. He said, you're going to get both of those if you ever touch that bottle. And when I was, I think I turned about 13, and I finally said, I'm not going. When they were going to take me to this place where I was abused, I said, I'm not going. And as soon as they pulled out of the driveway, I made a beeline for that bottle, and I steamed the seal off, and I drank every drop of whiskey that was in that bottle, and I felt like I belonged on earth. I had courage. I felt comfortable in my body. I'll never forget it. And it started then, and then I began stealing wine from neighbors. We had a lot of Italian neighbors in our
What happened with your dad when he found out?
Well, I filled it. I steamed the seal off, and I filled it up with water, and I put the seal back on and put it back in the shadow box. And it stayed there until just a few years ago, shortly before my father died. He was very ill, and I had made many amends to my parents in my sobriety, and that was one thing I had forgotten completely about. And I went to my father, and he was on his deathbed, and I told him that I said, Dad, I have to tell you something about that that whiskey bottle. He said, I know you drank it because you put the seal on upside down. But in any event, funny thing,
that's great.
Sometimes we carry this monkey around on our backs, afraid to make these amends, when in fact the people that, in my case, almost all of the people that I needed to make amends to were people that loved me and wanted very much to love me, and I made it impossible for them to do that in my addiction. In any event, from that point on, I drank heavily. I started smoking pot, then I started dealing it. I moved to New York when I was 17 to study acting at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And as soon as I came to New York, I started doing drugs and got into a very fast life. And I was in the club scene every night, all night, and losing a moral a day. And eventually, I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version. Eventually, I did get into show business and started working regularly as an actor and touring and often starring in tours of Broadway musicals and making a lot of money and living kind of a rock and roll lifestyle. And it was, I only had to work 2 hours a day to do the show, and I was drunk and high the rest of the time and could barely get through a paycheck, making several thousand dollars a week. And that business was very enabling. Oftentimes the promoters who knew I was a drug addict didn't want me jonesing out of town, so I would arrive at a venue and there would be a big, in my dressing room, there'd be a fruit basket, a bottle of Jack Daniels, and an 8-ball of cocaine. And I would always think, what's up with that fruit basket? But it was...
What, no bananas? Yes, we have bananas.
Who's going to eat a pineapple when you're doing an 8-ball of cocaine? In any event, eventually I could not work anymore. I was fired from my first Broadway show for shooting up heroin in between the first rehearsal and dinner break and coming back in the evening, and got fired. And, you know, now from the time I was 13 until this, now I'm 36, a lot of mess happened. I've been arrested a bunch of times, mostly for mouthing off to cops, and I sold drugs. I became a prostitute at one point. I lost all my morals. That's what drugs did for me. And by the end, my once loved apartment was in total squalor. Trash, filth, bugs, rats. I mean, it turned from a lovely home into a really a nightmare. And I would crawl around on the floor on my belly, afraid the ninja police were going to see me, extremely paranoid, and didn't leave the house except for very late at night, and I'd go out and mug people or do whatever I had to do to get money to get drugs. And my last night out, I woke up in a park in Forest Hills, Queens, and I was naked and covered with excrement, and I had been beaten badly. There were crack pipes stuffed in my mouth and broken teeth, and my jaw was broken, and black eyes, broken ribs. Somebody beat me and left me for dead. And to this day, I don't know what happened. Mercifully, that happened in a blackout, the memory of which has never returned. And truly, a miraculous thing happened that night. I ran out into the street, and there was one lone cab coming. Now, imagine you're a cab driver in New York City at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning in a remote part of Queens, and a naked man covered with excrement. At that point, I looked like a combination between Mel Gibson, Gary Busey, Nick Nolte, and Charles Manson all together on a very bad day.
But you were in Forest Hills, though, right? You were in Forest Hills?
Yes, I was, yes.
It's a little bit – Forest Hills is a nice area, so they might pick you up.
Well, naked and covered with excrement and bleeding. And
that would be tough. That would be tough. I can't see it.
This man, he looked at me, and he said, "Are you high?" And I said, "Not right at the moment, but I hope to be soon. I'll never forget it." And he had a tear in his eye, and he said, I know what you're going through." I know that man was, I've thought more about it over the years, I know that man had it. In any event, he got me back to my apartment. And
angel? You saying an angel?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I got back to my apartment, and I had to climb up 4 flights of a fire escape and break in through my bathroom window, and got cut quite a bit more, and I fell into the tub and cracked my head. All I could think about was, I've got crack pipes in there I could scrape. I must have some booze in there somewhere. And I went to the refrigerator. I hadn't eaten in many days, and I looked like a concentration camp victim, you know, completely. I photographed myself that night, and I take it with me when I tell my story and show people. In any event, I went to the refrigerator, and there was a small carton of milk, and I grabbed it, and I chugged it down. It had been spoiled for a very long time, and I began to retch, and I ran into the bathroom, and I vomited, and there was amber liquid, and it smelled like Jack Daniels. So and there were little white lumps along with it, and I stuck my head in the sink and lapped up the Jack Daniels, and then I tried to dry off those little white lumps because I was certain it was crack, and tried to smoke my vomit, and that's what I did until about the sun came up, and then I took a lot of pills and tried to commit suicide. And
wow.
As I was hitting the floor, and this is the Reader's Digest version, there was a lot of mess along the way to get to that point. I mean,
I'm getting the drift. Thank you.
It took me. You know, I don't like to focus on the war stories. I like to talk about solution.
The recovery, but it is what it is sometimes. And you're alive.
I went from a beautiful, beautiful, loving home in Ohio with wonderful, dear, kind parents and education. I was very involved in community theater, went to church. I was a good kid, you know, a really good kid, and well-liked, and won awards. I was in speech competition and did all sorts of things and was an outstanding student. And it took me from that to New York. I performed in theaters 800 cities around the globe, starring in major productions, and then ended up robbing people, mugging people, eating out of trash cans, smoking my vomit, naked in a park covered with excrement in the middle of the night, and that's where it took me, just to the lowest point. And as I was hitting the floor that night when I tried to commit suicide, I thought of a friend of mine who I hadn't talked to in a long time, and I called him, and he had played Colonel Pickering to my Henry Higgins. And the only reason I mention that is because the only way he knew who I was, I said, is this the Colonel? Because I always called him the Colonel. And so he knew it was me. And he came and found me, and he broke through my front door, and I had gone unconscious by that point. And he got me down 4 flights of steps and took me off to the hospital and then to rehab. And then became my first sponsor, took me to meetings. And it took me 3 trips. I relapsed twice. Went back to the rehab. First time he took me, the second time it was strongly suggested that I go back, and the third time I called and asked him if my room was empty, if it was available, wanted to go back. And I, when I came out, for the first, you know, we do a day count in New York where you go to a meeting and you say, I have, my name's Gary, I have 1 day, clean and sober, next day I have 2 days, 3 days, and so forth. Well, each day, my friend who saved my life, his name is Richard, who, by the way, he and I created Pass It On, An Evening with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, which I now tour in, and he is no longer with the show due to some health challenges, but such a miraculous thing that a dozen years later after he picked me up off the floor that he and I would travel the globe playing Bill W. and Dr. Bob. It's just unbelievable to me every day. I can hardly comprehend it.
Yeah, that's quite amazing, and I think you call it a miracle.
It is, and so what was I telling you? Oh, Richard would give me $3 a day because he figured I couldn't get into trouble, and I knew a pot dealer on 49th Street in New York City who would sell me one big fat joint, and I would sit on the stoop of a brownstone and smoke that joint, walk around for a couple hours, and go to my meeting and do my day count. And it turns out the chairperson of that meeting lived in that brownstone and was watching me smoke that joint every day. And everybody in that meeting knew that I was getting high and doing my day count. And I walked in on my 90 days, and all my friends, the only people left in my life from my old life were my long-suffering, loving parents. And everyone else was gone, had, would have nothing to do with me, and for good reason. And here were all these people who were being kind. They had a cake, they had presents, and, you know, they were going to have a little party for my 90 days. And they read that passage that says, there are those unfortunates who do not recover. These people seem to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I thought, holy God, that's me.
Right, you know, which I finished means, that. They're not at fault. They just seem to be blonde that way.
That's right. They just seem to have been born that way. And I thought, that is me. That's me. And so I jumped right up out of my seat, and I said, I don't have any clean time. I've been smoking pot every day. And of course, everybody knew it. They all cheered, jumped up and down, and I stayed sober from that day. And It's been 17 years, an amazing 17 years.
Wow, what a story.
Congratulations.
I know it's the Reader's Digest story, and I think that's just as well. I personally, when I go to some speaker meetings, I find it kind of anticlimactic when the speaker can't get off for the problem. They'll spend the hour giving the drunk log, and yours is quite unique, and you know, to that extent, I mean, it's fairly drastic. But I've heard comparable, you know, then some funny stuff, and you know, and I can understand that. But to spend the whole hour, and then like in the last 3 minutes, they say, yeah, and then I work the steps, and now I'm good. Thank you. Good night. You know, like,
I'll confess when I'm speaking in public and telling my story, when I have an hour, it's peppered with drunkologue, but I talk about solution all through it, and so that clearly gets put in, and I can't help but try to be funny because I'm an entertainer. I like to make people laugh, and I think we deserve to laugh. I like to laugh in sobriety.
Once you got them laughing, you got them listening.
That's true. That's absolutely right. That's right. It's been an amazing 17 years in sobriety. I couldn't go near show business for a very long time. It was very triggery, and I ended up working on Wall Street.
Let's go back. Can we go back a little bit? I wanted to hear a little bit about, okay, yeah, you know, the 17 years of sobriety. Now, you're working with a sponsor. Did he find you? You found him?
Other than Richard, when I first came in, he just sort of said, okay, I'm going to kind of sponsor you. And then quickly I needed a different sponsor because we were friends. And I always found my sponsors. When I make up my mind to do something, I do it. I've always been that way. When one day crack wasn't doing it for me anymore, I actually picked up the phone. I made a decision to learn how to use heroin. I made a decision, and I went for it, and it became a hardcore junkie. I've always been that way, and I recovered the same way.
How did you find your sponsor? Did he say something in the meeting, a firm handshake? He owned AT&T. How did you pick this guy?
Well, I asked old-timers, and I read literature and had an idea in my head. What I had been taught was that a sponsor, to find someone who seemed at peace, who lived in harmony with other people, who was well-liked and loved, and not a person who was in drama and conflict, and who lived in the steps, who was step-oriented, who had worked, it was all about working the steps and then living in the steps. And so I just listened to people speak. I went to meetings where there were old-timers. I wanted somebody with a lot of sobriety, and met someone. I heard someone speak, and I knew he was the person, and went up and asked him, and he became my sponsor. I've had a couple of sponsors. In each case,
the first guy, now he started taking you through the steps right away, or what was his agenda?
Yes, he did. In fact, he was my sponsor I had maybe 30 days of sobriety when he became my sponsor, and we spent time together every single day. He lived in New York, also in the same neighborhood, and went to a lot of meetings, so I stayed with him all the time. At the time, he's now a Unity minister, but at the time he was the lighting director and designer for a nightclub in New York. And so I would go with him every night and sit in the booth and drink cranberry juice and watch all these nightclub acts, just because I just didn't want to leave his side. I was with him all the time. And when I had about 60 days, we had been talking a lot about 1, 2, and 3. I wasn't working at the time, and he took me to his apartment on a Thursday night, and we came out on Monday morning, and we had done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And a lot of talking, ate a lot of candy and donuts and smoked cigarettes and drank a lot of soda and cried a lot.
I agree with that 100%. I always believe that you can do the first 3 steps sitting at a traffic light, as long as you're not in New York City.
No doubt about it, Joseph. I was recently down in Delray, Florida, doing Pass It On, and even with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, and Wally P., who wrote Back to Basics, our dear friend, was giving a talk that night. You know, he travels around taking people to the steps. And he took a room of 150 people through 1, 2, and 3 in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And,
the reason I
really
say New York City, you know why I say except New York City? Because the New York minute is made up of the annoyed nanosecond. That's the only that's why I say not New York City. But other than that, the first three steps are in agreements. That's it. There's really no work. Yes, I can't. I've had enough. My life is unmanageable. I can't deal with it. Yes, something outside of me has got to be able to do this because I can't. And the third one is I agree that God's going to be able to do this for me if I turn it over to him. That's it. 1, 2, and 3. Okay, now let's work the fourth step.
I'll tell you, the fourth step for me was seminal. Everything about that was truly a shift in my psyche and my whole state of being. And my sponsor's name is Sean. He also has a radio program, by the way, today. It's called The Good Show with Reverend Sean, and he's become a minister, and I'm frequently on his show. In any event, I was still so shaky and mucus and foggy brain that I could not really write a fourth step. And he made a chart, and we picked 12 people, 12 names, and did the fourth step with these 12 so that I would understand what the tool was. And he said, we're looking for patterns here. And I looked at this, and I saw what my issues were, what my fear, and here's for me what was the radical shift. I suddenly realized that I was not a victim ever,
mm-hmm.
that I had been powerfully creating my life, including the drama and the mess. I created the mess. And that, in my mind, I suddenly realized that I could shift the focus of my creative energy, healing and working these steps and on a recovery path, that the same energy I used to destroy my life, I could build my life, and I was so hopeful to me, and I realized, and I've never felt like I'm a victim again in my life. And I realized it by working those just 12 names that all of the people that I had a resentment against actually really loved me, tried very hard to love me, and I made it impossible for them to do that. And for that, I had a resentment. No.
When I worked my fourth, when I finally got...
Anybody that's listening that hasn't worked the steps, if you're afraid of them, please believe me when I tell you the steps are not a punishment. They are there for our comfort. And I don't know about any of you, but this addict and alcoholic is all about comfort. it's just an amazing, powerful tool.
When I got to my fourth step, and it took me forever, longer than I get to admit, I was doing the AA three-step, I probably would have never got to a fourth step until life on life's terms beat me up again and I had to do something. My sponsor used to say, Joseph, you're not going to get any of the promises until you've worked your fourth step. And I found out there's a lot of folks like that in the program. They go to meetings, meetings become the solution, and the fourth steps are never addressed. And if it goes long enough, it never gets done, but they maintain a form of sobriety. And then, of course, is sobriety enough? Well, we think a man unthinking, but some folks will disagree with you on that. So when I wrote my fourth step, when I finally got to it, I kept running out of the room at the back where it says my part. There was not enough room on the paper for my part. I got down to the little edge there, and then some pages there was no room. And my sponsor goes, well, you didn't do much on your part. I says, well, you know, because I was a victim. All this, people did stuff to me, and so I was a victim on all this. And he said, no, you don't get it. This is the most important part is your part.
Yeah.
And when I finally came to that agreement, I understood that I was participating in my own demise.
Yes, that's what I was trying to articulate, exactly how I felt, exactly how I felt. I thought it had happened to me. So I could no longer say, oh, poor me. I realized that I powerfully created that mess. and did one hell of a job of it. And now, in the last 17 years, I've built a new life. And
Had the fifth step, did you have a spiritual, your fifth step, was it a spiritual experience, an awakening, or your fifth?
You know, it was so cathartic. It was just, it was like demons left my body, just left my being by confessing and being honest and saying things out loud to someone that I never thought I could say out loud. And the remarkable thing, which I've experienced many times since then in listening to fifth steps with other people, I thought I was such a monster. And I did some pretty crazy things, and I'm kind of twisted in a creative way. So in my using, I did do some unique, bizarre things. But as I would tell what I thought were monstrous, shameful things, Sean, who was listening in my fifth step, would laugh. And he'd go, oh, did you do that too? Oh, yeah, me too, and I did it this way. And I suddenly realized that it was how the grotesque things that happened to me have happened to all of us. And then we all have those behavioral issues in common, and then I'm not alone anymore, and I'm not a monster. I was just not a bad person, just an ill person trying to get well. And my God, the whole thing is just so remarkable, the whole shift in my thinking. What made a whole, you know, whole new world, universe possible to me, as I know you guys. Now, anybody that's in the program that works the steps, and I couldn't agree with you more. I find it very troubling when I go to meetings and people, there's this, it's kind of like, I'm okay, you're okay, AA. And, you know what I mean? And everybody, like you said, they just say, well, just go to meetings. Don't drink, go to meetings. And that, I have several sponsees in some of the narcotic programs who have HIV from their drug use. And I always tell this when I tell my story. They are clear that HIV is a disease. And there are three medicines that they take to stay well. And by God, they take those pills because they know if they don't take them, they're going to suffer horribly and die. And those steps, just going to meetings, There's more, as you know, there are three pills that we take, three medicines that we take, meetings, being of service to another sick and suffering alcoholic, not just cleaning out the ashtrays and putting the chairs away, but actually working with another alcoholic and working the steps. And if you don't take all three of those medications, you're not getting well. And your chances for staying sober are slim. And if you do stay sober, you'll probably be miserable, as we all know, hundreds of miserable dry drunks.
I add something in. Usually, some people call it the lost verse in the 12 and 12 on step five.
Okay.
Until we welcome with complete candor to someone, and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step five was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So it's asking us not only to speak a fifth step, but to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? Sponsor hears a fifth step. So until you've sponsored someone through a fifth step, you still didn't belong. You were circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it was another crash and burn. But a lot of people don't get that. No, well, we don't see that.
You know, I know a lot of people that seem to be hesitant. I have a number of friends who are hesitant to sponsor because they have this idea that a sponsor becomes your banker, your mother, your psychiatrist, your consigliere, and to my way of thinking, a sponsor is an accountability partner for your sobriety who works steps with you, and that's not your not your therapist,
that's
not
period.
Your lawyer,
that's
your
it.
Banker, not your accountant, or your mother. And well, I can understand
people,
that could be a very draining, codependent job if that's the way you're sponsoring somebody.
And advice, when it comes to advice, I advise people never to give advice. We put all that on Rum Radio. All that's on there, what a sponsor does and doesn't do. It's all enumerated, all from the big book and the 12 and 12, messages from the heart, you know, all back to basics.
I was taught to ask, what's troubling you? And listen and say, okay, what step could we apply to this? And that's what it is. We're not therapists.
No. Even if we're our therapists, they're not our patients. I have a little story for you. I have this fellow who went through the steps, and his sponsor started encouraging him to sponsor. And he said, look, he says, every time I had a problem and I called you, you told me what page in the big book to look. Page 99, page 69, page 76. And he says, every time you told me, I would find the answer to my question in the big book. He says, I will never know the big book like you know the big book. He says, let me tell you something. When you asked me those questions, I gave you a page. I just gave you random numbers. You found the answer you were looking for. Now go sponsor somebody.
Yeah, it's incredibly important to do that. We have to give it away.
People don't get it.
We also have to pass the program on. I'm sorry, what's that, Joseph?
It's about, you know what it is? It's 20% of the people are doing 80% of the work. People get lives after they've gone through the steps or they get sober. They get girlfriends, they get wives, they got jobs, they got businesses, they got children. They're busy. They got full lives.
Yeah.
How about giving it back? You know, hey, first of all, I really don't not quite sure what my sponsor did in the first place. We just kind of hung out. And then so he doesn't really know what to do. That's one. Two, I'm just too busy. And three, I don't want to be responsible for another human being. What if I make a mistake and the guy dies? Those are the three main excuses I find for people not sponsoring.
No doubt. No doubt. I know that I'm powerless over them, and all I can do is offer the help of guiding them through the steps and stay sober. And as far as going, you know, really staying invested in the program and working the program, you're right, we do have busy lives. I find that staying in the fellowship, in the meetings, and working a program enhances everything that I do. It enhances my business life, my personal relationships, every aspect of my life is better because I take the time to do that. It's like a
good point.
Spiritual gym. I mean, no matter what it is, even if you're busy in business, there's nothing like being in the middle of the fellowship. You walk with an army at your side, which is not a bad thing when you're in business.
No.
To know.
How about
to
the
know,
step now? You've worked. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Say again.
How about the sixth step? You did the fifth. You did the sixth right after, right?
Yes.
Immediately.
Absolutely. Yes.
And I find, you know, personally, I find that if I used to lose sponsees after the fifth step. If I lost them, I'd lose them after five, and I couldn't figure it out. Because the big book says it separates the men from the boys, the girls from the women, you know, the sheep from the goats and the fox from the hounds. You know, what's the big deal on the sixth step? And you know what I figured out, what was going on? Once they've had that connection with God on the fifth step, the pain was gone.
Right.
And the pain is the fuel that gets them through the steps. So if you linger after the fifth step, you're going to lose them. Because they have no, the motivation to work it is gone. They're less than halfway through, and their lives are good. They're not going to drink, and they're quite content. And they have no energy to continue on. I really believe that pain that walk in with is fuel. It's fuel to get them through.
Oh, no doubt about it. Like
usually what I'll do is I tell my sponsees, no talking in the meetings. Suggest not to talk in the meetings until they work the fifth step. Because what I found out, what happens is that when they start talking in the meetings, the pain goes away. I don't know why it does, but you talk in a meeting, a recovery meeting, and people are loving on you, and they're glad you're there, and you're feeling embraced by a new tribe, and you know, things are getting good. You're not drinking. All those things are going away. And so, you know, the pain's gone. How about working the steps? How about working the fourth step? I'm staying sober. Is that not enough? And I think that's what's really created the spin-dry cycle of the revolving door. We're lingering.
No doubt about it. I don't remember the statistics, but I recall seeing them at one point, talking with Wally about it when AA first started, when 12-step recovery was born, and they worked the steps. Wally had told me what a sponsor did. They came in, they picked you up, and they took you to a place where other drunks and sponsors were. And the first Friday night, you did 1, 2, and 3. And the next Friday, you did 4, 5, 6, and so on for 4 weeks. Then you could go to the meeting because you had a tool that you could now go help somebody else. And people that did that, something like some high percentage, like 80-some percent, maybe in the high 80s, stayed so achieved.
Well, initially they said 50% got well right away and another 25% after a few relapses.
Okay. So
that's great.
Today, like 20% or something, that's way, way lower today.
It's way lower. It, you know, nobody knows for sure because it's not, you know, it's like counting cats, but there's certain numbers, you know, of how much the program has not grown compared to the relative population growth. So those numbers are fairly accurate.
I work closely with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, which was conceived by Bill and Lois, Bill Wilson and Lois Wilson in 1944, and started by AA's first woman drunk, Marty Mann. And Bob Lindsay, who has been the president and CEO of the National Council, he's just stepped down, actually, sadly. He's an amazing man. He had often said that he would go on speaking junkets, oftentimes speaking before Congress and the senators and so forth. And these legislators would often say, you know, they're supporting Big Pharma instead of a 12-step because there's no money in it. And their reasoning is they say, well, it doesn't work. It only works for some people. And Bob said he would always reply by saying, you show me one serious, maybe fatal, progressive illness that has a treatment that works 100% of the time for everyone.
Yeah, there
isn't. There is no such thing. But the thing is, 12-step recovery does work for anyone who works it. If you actually do it, you will get results. There's absolutely no doubt about it, if you do the work.
You'll get what we get if you do what we do. So now you got six, seven and eight. You got those? Eight, nine? What is, seven is really not too much there. That's another one. We turn it over to God. It's a humility step. You know, we're willing to get our character defects gone. So there's really not too much effort in seven. It's just kind
of
being willing.
You know, I thought when I first was coming to know the seventh step, I thought that they were just going to magically disappear. But really, what happened for me, through working the steps, I became very aware of what they were. And though I had given them to God, quote unquote, some of them I like to hang on to like I was sitting around in a pair of dirty drawers until I finally said, okay, it's time to take these off and put a clean pair on. And so I was really willing to let go of it. I had to wallow painfully in my character defects. Some of them still. And I've also come to believe that what we sometimes refer to as character defects are actually God-given gifts that we're just using in an improper way, in a way that's not effective.
I like that.
Because any of those, pride, anger, you know, whatever those are, if they're right-sized and used properly and focused in a proper way. And so I find a lot of my what were defects, I just use them in a different way now that's productive instead of destructive.
Ah, interesting. Okay, and eight. Now, eight, you made a list of people that you had harmed, and you were willing to make amends to them all. So how did that look?
Definitely. You know, funny, there was I had a pretty long list, and I was willing to go to anybody, and I worked hard at it. And there were a couple of people that I had to say, I'm going to do this later. I'm not ready. I'm not comfortable. One in particular was a producer, and I couldn't imagine going to this man. I didn't want to go to him to make amends until I was clear that I did not want to be in show business, because I second-guessed that he would think, oh, here's this actor coming to him saying, oh, I'm sorry, thinking I want a job. So 8 years into my sobriety, 9 years into my sobriety, I began having nightmares about this man. I mean, terror mares. It was happening all the time. And I told my sponsor and my spiritual director, and they both said, "Wasn't that man on your original 8-step list? Maybe it's time to make that amends." And I did, and it was an amazing experience, which resulted in me, actually, even though I did not go to him looking for a job, it resulted in me getting back into show business, briefly doing a couple of national tours, which led me to the off-Broadway play Bill W. and Dr. Bob by Samuel Shem and Janet Suri, my dear friends, which is currently running off-Broadway, by the way, at the Soho Playhouse. It opened June 16th. It's the first off-Broadway show in theater history to be produced entirely through tax-deductible donations to the executive producer, which is Hazelden Foundation, and all of the proceeds from it are being used to send suffering alcoholics into treatment. So it's an off-Broadway
show. Oh, wonderful.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it's just an amazing
thing. Oh, it's a nice tone to it. Yeah, that's charity. Yeah, that's no doubt.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the first in the secular theater world in New York where someone has done something like that. And anyway, that making that amends directly led me into Bill W. and Dr. Bob, which that show then led to the ministry that I now have, passed it on. And even with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, I'm traveling all over the country as a 12-step advocate, teaching the history of AA through a live stage production, and it's become my...
Well, how about 10, 11, and 12? Do you call those the maintenance steps or the growth steps? What do you come on? What side of that argument do you come out on?
Well, I think they're both things. No doubt about it. It's definitely maintenance. There's certainly a lot of growth in stopping at the end of each day and saying, you know, where was I my highest, most noble self, and where was I not? Where did I come up short? Who did I possibly harm that I could go tomorrow, first thing in the morning, and apologize? And after you do that enough, your personality starts to change. You start to shut your mouth before you say something caustic to someone. Anyway, so that's a lot of growth. It's maintenance, but it's also growth. And
what I found on the 10th step, you know why it's important to make an amends quickly? Because it's easier to eat crow while it's still warm.
Well, you know, that's really true. If you wait longer, it festers and it rots and it, you know.
In a riot, it's hard to swallow. You know, that swallow turns out into an egret of regret. You know, like, I can't do it. It's grown too large now. You know, the ego gets all involved, yeah.
To comment on that, this producer that I had mentioned that I had had nightmares about, prior to making the amends, it had been a number of years since I had seen him. The last time I had seen him, we were having a fist fight, and I had worked for him off and on doing Broadway musicals for 20-some years, and he fired me as many times as he hired me, and I realized in the fourth step that this man actually loved me, and, you know, I just made it impossible. In any event, the last time I had seen him, he started screaming, "It's not show friends, it's show business. I'm not your friend. I'm your booker. It's show business." Well,
he really liked you, though. I could tell. He really liked you.
Many years later, I sit down with him. I call him up on a Sunday night, and I say, "I've been having nightmares about you." And he says, "As well, you should." And I said, "I'm sober." He said,
I knew that.
He said, "I knew that. I heard through the grapevine." And he said, "What's taking you so long to call me?" And I said, I explained that I wanted to be clear that I didn't want anything from him. I just wanted to be able to meet him and look him in the face, thank him for all of the good that he brought into my life and name that, and then name out loud the harm that I believed I had caused him. So when we got together the next day, at the Kraft Diner, which is no longer there in New York on 42nd Street, and between 9th and 10th. And at the end of this amends lunch, we ended up spending morning and well into late afternoon together. He walked me back to my apartment building, and he opened his arms, and he hugged me, and he looked at me, and he said, "Show friends." And that, in that moment, I realized that this amends process not only sets us free, it sets the other people free, too.
Yes.
That he had been carrying that around with him all those years, that he remembered screaming that at me. you know, that that was on his consciousness, and then he was free too. It's just such a powerful healing. Yeah, of course, that's
I like to think. I like to think step 10 is steps 4 through 9 in a single package taken in the present.
Oh, I like that. I never thought of that.
And then step 11, I put this together. Prayer is the quarterback. Meditation is the feedback. And self-examination is the goal line.
The first time I worked my, really worked my 11th step, I went on retreat to the Abbey of Gethsemane in Bardstown, Kentucky, which is a monastery where the monks take a vow of silence. And then I later took several sponsees on retreats there where we would go and spend 2 or 3 weeks in silence where you don't speak there at all, and doing writing and meditating and in community with other people and eating. And then later I actually checked into the Abbey and stayed there for many months. And following 9/11, I was in the South Tower on 9/11 in the World Trade Center. I had gotten a job working on Wall Street. May I mention about this? To me, it's a powerful, it's the most powerful illustration that I have about the healing power of doing service. In recovery, I had my first recovery gig was working in customer service for a large brokerage firm on Wall Street, and then I became a stockbroker, and eventually had an off over a number of years. I didn't go back into show business. I worked on Wall Street, and one of the offices that I worked at was on the 28th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. And I, as much as I'm an alcoholic, I'm a workaholic, and I worked and worked and worked myself to the bone. It was a very high-pressure, adrenaline rush sort of job, and being a broker. In those days, that's when the market was, internet trading was new. In any event, it was quite a rush. And I have an autoimmune disorder that I've been being treated for my whole life, and had pretty much forgotten about it. It was basically in remission, and suddenly I broke out with the shingles and was exhausted. I could barely move, and the shingles not only spread along the course of normally it's on like one side of your spine, it was on both sides, up my neck, on my face, all over my body. I went to the doctor, and my immune system was all but gone. And I was told to get my affairs in order. And there was even mention of the word hospice, which I did not care for. And I decided to take a Greyhound bus to Ohio to tell my long-suffering elderly parents that I was going to die soon. And I took the bus because I just wanted to have time to repair. By the time I got there, I was so ill. And I'm allergic to Zithromax, which is the common treatment for the shingles. And they wanted to give me narcotic painkiller, but I didn't want to wake Flacco up. Now, today, I have a different feeling about that. I would have the narcotic painkiller. I would go to great lengths to make sure that if I had to, that someone kept them across the street and they gave me my 2 pills every couple hours, I'd run across the street and get them so that I wouldn't abuse it. But because I was a wicked narcotic addict. In any event, my trip to Ohio was on September 1st and was scheduled to come back on September 11th. And on the morning of the late evening of the 9th, I made the decision that I would go back to New York early. I never did tell my parents that really what was going on. They just saw that I had the shingles and said, oh, you just work too much, you're exhausted, and that's something old people get, and you shouldn't have the shingles. In any event, I got up and I went back to New York, and on 9/10, I went to see a friend of mine who is an Episcopal priest in the program, and I showed him what was going on with my body, and he suggested that I come and go home and get my things and come over there, and he would make me comfortable, and they'd talk about hospice and all this, and you know, everybody was ready to bury me. And instead, the next morning, I got up and I went down to Wall Street to quit my job and say goodbye to everybody. And I went down, I had a sponsee there who met me for breakfast, and we were eating oatmeal at Fine and Shapiro's Deli when the first plane hit. And all hell broke loose. And, you know, they chained the doors so that you couldn't get out because they didn't want – people were being armed from glass and stuff coming down. Anyway, just not what, why the reason I'm talking about this. So the only way we were able to get out of the building, there was actually a sometime and not very often recovering alcoholic that I knew from the Wall Street meeting was a security guard who was – drunk that morning, and it kind of got to be a joke around the firm. Whatever that guy told you to do, like we'd go in on a weekend and he'd say, oh, don't go in that door, you got to go around the building. He was always wrong, the opposite was always correct. So the joke was, whatever he said, do the opposite thing, you'll be in good shape. And he walked up to us and said, whatever you do, don't see the building. And my sponsor, he looked at me, just get the hell out of here. And and he laughed at it. You know, nobody imagined that this dear drunk, he died in the towers. Yeah. God rest his soul, and but he helped save our lives. So in any event, we went. We had to slide down a metal spot in between the up and down escalators because it was just so crowded. And my sponsee literally had to pick me up, toss me down there because I was basically crippled from the shingles because they're very, very painful, and kind of paralyze your muscles. So he then picked me up and tossed me to the PATH train, and we were on the last train out of the building. Came up the other side to watch the other plane hit. Now, at that point, you know, that big gray cloud came across the river, and people were screaming and running toward west, toward New Jersey. It was just terrifying. And I looked at my sponsee, and I said, I'm dying. The world is coming to an end. New York has just been bombed. Let's go smash the window of a liquor store and get hammered. And he punched me in the face. He punched me in the face. God bless the newcomer, my sponsee of 2 months. And and he was standing there. I'm laying on the ground in that cloud, you know, that gray yuck, and he's screaming at me, and just we're all in shock. Why don't we say that stupid prayer you're always trying to get me to say? So we got on our knees, and we said the third step prayer. No sooner had we said that, there an SUV came by with the insignia of the Episcopal Diocese of New York, and driving that SUV was a priest from the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, where I had then been attending church in sobriety and was on the vestry. And he had counseled me in early sobriety, and he saw me, and he said, my God, you look awful. In any event, he laid hands on us and said, okay, you're now clergy, and they need lots of clergy, and you're going to be at a triage. You're going to do service. And we had just said the third step prayer. So we were taken, there were a series of tents at the water's edge in downtown Hoboken, Harborside it's called. And there was a black tent for body parts and a red tent for massive wounds and a yellow tent for developing wounds and a green tent for people who were in shock. And Father Lou said, your job, they took us to a sports bar, actually, and we were suited up in hazmat suits. And then a purple cross on a little tag was placed on my chest over my heart, and I was sent to be clergy. And
the green tent.
These are the strange things that happen in sobriety. And my job was to hug people and ask, and he said, do what you do in AA. Ask them what happened and listen to their story. That's it. That's the healing. That's the healing power. That's what you're going to do. And for the next 3 days, I hugged maybe 30, 40,000 people. Now, my friend Richard always told me I was exaggerating until on the 10th anniversary, I was on a special on ABC television about 9/11, and on that special, Katie Couric said that 500,000 people came through that triage. And I looked at Richard and I said, you see, I only hugged a fraction of them. Anyway, as I would hug these people, I would feel the pustules from the shingles popping open and oozing inside my hazmat suit. And by the end of the third day, I was carrying bags of 150-pound bags of ice unloading off the truck. And it occurred to me that I was feeling pretty good, and I hadn't slept. I really hadn't eaten much. I was deathly ill 3 days before. And they finally opened one of the train tunnels to let service workers go back to Manhattan. And I live on 42nd Street, as does my Episcopal priest friend, who I had shown my shingles to, and he suggested that we call hospice. So I went to his apartment at about 2 o'clock in the morning wearing my hazmat suit, walking down 42nd Street, and went to his house. And they had all thought, everybody but him, they all thought that I had died in the towers because nobody had heard from me because there was no cell phone. Anyway, he said, go in, take a shower. I'll make you something, come out and tell us what happened, and you can bear with us. And I went into the shower, and those shingles, 10 days, no immune system, no medication, had scabbed up and washed off my body. And I was, and I haven't been ill a day. That the autoimmune disorder that I had, I no longer have. And
wow.
this is my truth about the power of service, and it's why I have dedicated my life from that day forward to living a life of service and carrying the message, because I saw in my own body. Now, the Episcopal priest who I mentioned, he said to me, this is a miracle, and miracles happen hundreds of thousands of times a day. They're not unusual occurrences. They happen all around us if we're just able to see them and call them what they are. And it happened to you, Gary, not because you're special or you're better than anybody, because you gave yourself completely in service to others. And it's one of the immutable laws of God's universe that when you give yourself completely in service, you are given love to give away. And as that love passed through you, it healed you. It was such a profound experience for me. And being an alcoholic, I want more of everything that's good. So having had that experience, I said, great, I'm going to do service for the rest of my life. And that's what I do today, and that's how I live my life. And
well, that brings us to step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. I have a Cahil Gibran. Spiritual awakening is the most essential thing in a man's life and is the sole purpose of being. It sounds like you're doing your 12-step work.
I believe that I am. I believe that I live in that step. It's what motivates me to get up in the morning. It's the most amazing thing when you get on your knees. I find that when I pray and I get my legs involved, it really helps solidify the prayer. And it moves along a lot faster, I think, because I become more willing to listen and speak more honestly with God. Every time I ask for someone to be of service to, all I do is walk out the door and they show up. And it's just the most amazing experience to me. So today, that's what I do with my life. I created Pass It On, an evening with Bill W. and Dr. Bob, which is a live stage production presented by the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. And we travel all over God's creation. And I play Bill Wilson in it, and another gentleman plays Dr. Bob. And it's as if you're at an old-time recovery meeting with Bill and Bob as the keynote speakers, and they share their experience, strength, and hope, tell their stories, and then dramatize certain key events in their lives, such as their drinking sprees and the night they met in Akron. And the second act is all about how they wrote the big book and created the steps and got the meeting started. And then the summation of the piece is old-time AA religion. It's you come to the show, you'll number one, you'll identify if you're an alcoholic, and you'll leave with a solution and have been entertained in the process. And it's been an amazing experience. We created the business model for it also to be of service, so that the costs are extremely low, so that it can be used as a fundraising tool for recovery organizations that host the show. And that's been very successful as we've traveled around the last couple of years. And also working on a film, which is called, if anybody wants to know about Pass It On, we have a Facebook page, Pass It On, at Evening with Bill W. and Dr. Bob. You can contact me there. Or call the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence in New York at their national office if you're interested in the show and the project. And also there's a film that's being made by Northern Light Productions. And I really appreciate you giving me time to talk about this. It's Northern Light Productions are from Boston. They make many films for WGBH PBS in Boston and have long-standing contracts, have made films for the National Park Service and I think the National Gallery, Ford's Theater. They made the new film for the 9/11 Museum. They're amazing filmmakers. They make films for HBO and Discovery Channel and principally PBS. They have a long history with PBS. And we are working in partnership with Hazel and Betty Ford and an amazing group of advisors on this film. What the film is, it's called One Day at a Time, The History, Hope, and Healing of 12-Step Recovery, and it's a landmark television documentary. PBS, through American Public Television and with the help of the BBC, have committed to broadcast this globally. And after its initial worldwide television broadcast, and what it is, the film details not the train wreck, it's about solution. It details the spirituality and the science of 12-step recovery, the history, how it has grown and transformed into the many fellowships and become a global healing phenomenon. One of the goals is that every person on Earth will know about it because we know today statistically that, for instance, membership in AA specifically in North America is declining exponentially year by year. And through telephone calls that were tracked when people call for help, last year over 700,000 people called and were identified as people who never heard of 12-step recovery or AA or Al-Anon. And so after its initial worldwide television broadcast, it will be distributed, accompanied by educational materials that are being created by Hazelden Publishing, and they'll be made available to all the public schools in the United States and the universities, community colleges, and the military and other institutions. So with the goal that every kid growing up in America will not only know about George Washington, Abe Lincoln, and the Wright brothers, but about Bill and Bob and Lois and what happened in Akron in 1935, and the solution to America's number one public health issue and the global pandemic of addiction and alcoholism. And the film is funded through tax-deductible donations, and you can go to www.onedayatatimethemovie.com, make a donation, learn about the project. There are many ways to be of service to this project other than contributing financially, but it's an auspicious project. So that's what I do to be of service, as well as work with my sponsees and help old ladies across the street. So thank you for letting me get that out. I hope
you're
it
welcome.
Didn't hijack your program.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, we're in the business to help. That's it. However that might look to other people, it doesn't matter. Every man has their own understanding. I believe everyone should have access to information. No one should be denied the access, and every man makes up his own decision whether the information is valid or not.
Absolutely.
That's it. That's as simple as it gets. I believe that I came across this the program doesn't demand that you believe in God. And I found out that God doesn't demand that you believe in him either.
Right. You know,
I read that and I was really kind of surprised. It says, choose you this day whom you will serve. And there's no punishment for not believing in God. And what that does is it puts all men on equal ground.
Yeah.
So choice is the cornerstone of recovery.
No doubt about it. That one simple phrase, God as we understood it, has been a lifesaver for millions. Just
right, and you know, and the thing I don't understand why people have such a hard time with that. They just do. I see AA. I wrote a post on Rum Radio. It's called AA Threatens to Fire God, Demands More Benefits and Less Participation.
That's very funny. You know, I used good orderly direction, and that worked. I used group of drunks, and that worked. Then at one point, I started thinking of God as a verb rather than a pronoun, and that worked. And then my sponsor suggested, he asked me, what's the issue with God? And I was afraid of God because of the way I had behaved. And he said, if you could describe God on your own terms, and what would it be? And I said, well, it would be like George Burns in that movie, Oh God. And a couple days later, he handed me a little gift wrap package, and he had found a George Burns bobblehead. And he said, put this on your windowsill, put a pillow on the floor, kneel in front of it, and talk to George, and pray. And it worked, and miracles happened in my life. Extraordinary things happened, and that began, that really for me, that began my prayer life. And I saw God as something loving, benevolent, with a sense of humor, because he was George Burns. And I still sort of think of God that way, although it's a kind of a cross between George Burns and a verb. I can't really explain it. You know, we say we have a God of our understanding. I do not have a God of my understanding. I have a God that I experience, but I don't understand it. And I'm okay with that. I also don't understand electricity, but I don't sit in the dark room. I go ahead and flip the switch. I don't know how it works, but I flip the switch.
It goes like this, Gary. Trying to describe God was like asking a fish to describe the water it swims in.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, it's impossible to do. But I
it's not going to happen.
I experienced something in my life. There's no doubt about it.
That's great. Well, thank you. Harold, do you have something? Do you have something you want to add?
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I'm with you two. I had a rough time with God in the beginning of the program, and it was so great that I could come into the rooms, I could work the steps, and there was great warmth and acceptance there. That really saved my life. And so I want to give back. Service is the key. Thank you, Joseph.
You're welcome, Harold.
Amen to that.
And thanks again. This has been great. I enjoyed it immensely. I can see why you're a good actor. You tell a really good story.
Riveted. You're very kind. You're very kind. Thank you. It's a blessing to have been on, and thank you for your service and what you do to help so many people.
You're welcome.
God bless you.
In closing, thank you. In closing, I'd like to tell you, Rum Radio and rumradio.org, we're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and between 300,000 and 400,000 hits to the website. We've gone around the world. We're very popular in Nepal. You know why?
Why is that?
They like our yak.
Are you a New Yorker,
am.
Joseph?
I am. I vision a day in the distant future where a chicken can cross the road and its motives will not be suspicious. Anyway,
well,
so thank you
so
much.
You have a new fan now. I'll be listening on Sundays.
Oh, great. Well, you know, if you ever want to call in, we always, you know, people usually, they listen to it on the archives. We've had as many, two or three weeks ago, 2,400 listens to the
wow.
to the archives.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
You know, and that's great. You know, and sometimes I'd like some folks to call in, but so far, very few will ever bother. I think it's a kind of an intimidation kind of deal, I guess. I don't know. Or are they just going to listen at their time and at their pace? But we're glad that we're getting
around. I give you my word, you'll be hearing from me.
All right, I'll take that.
And we may be seeing you. Pass it on an evening with Bill W. and Dr. Bob's coming to San Antonio and I think Dallas-Fort Worth. Possibly Houston. That's in talks right now. So we may run into you.
Oh yeah, that would that would be great.
I'll definitely let you know. Thank you so much.
Please.
God bless you both.
You're welcome. Good. So we need to close. And remember, if you need sponsorship information, we have some of the best you can find. It's all Big Book 12 and 12 from the heart. All program agreed principles. It's spiritual and it's humorous, because once you got them laughing, you got them listening. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you so much.